Welcome to Clinical Conversations 115th podcast. It comes to you from Journal Watch, whose website is at jwatch.org. I'm Joe Ilya. It's March 9th, 2011. This time, in collaboration with Cardio Exchange, we investigate how best to use the new anticoagulant dabigatran for preventing stroke in patients with atrial fibrillation. A transcript of this podcast will appear on the Cardio Exchange website. The address is www.cardioexchange.org. We've invited a cardiologist and an internist to discuss dabigatran and its implications for clinical practice. Dr. Elaine Heilig is Associate Professor of Medicine in the Department of Medicine at Boston University School of Medicine, where she is Director of the Thrombosis and Anticoagulation Service. Dr. Samuel Goldhaber is Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School and Director of the Venous Thromboembolism Research Group in the Cardiovascular Division at Brigham and Women's Hospital, where he is a staff cardiologist. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My first question deals with pronunciation. I know that the drug company prefers dabigatran, but what's the street pronunciation of this stuff? Do you ever hear dabigatran?
Well, I'll be honest with you. I mean, I actually hear dabigatran more often, I think, than I hear the other, so I'm sure I'm going to refer to this new drug as dabigatran. How about you, Sam?
Well, I'm bilingual, Elaine, and just like at Brigham and Women's Hospital, most of us speak at least medical Spanish and English. I say and hear and understand dabigatran and dabigatran, but as you also know, Elaine, when I'm talking with you and other experts, I have a nickname that we use, Dabby.
Right.
All right. Well,
Very good.
I'm going to try to use dabigatran just to, I don't know, just to be formal, and forgive me for that. So let me ask the general question. And Elaine, let's start with your answer to this, if we could. Are there patients whom you would definitely or definitely not put on dabigatran?
Well, I mean, I think this is certainly an interesting question. It's the burning question certainly out there in the field right now. You know, I think this is an exciting time for all of us in the thromboembolism field. Dabigatran, I think that the results of the RELIE trial were fantastic. It was hard to believe that you could actually have a novel agent that reduced the risk of intracerebral bleeding, which I think is something that we've all been waiting to see if this was going to be a characteristic of the 10A inhibitors, and, you know, early results seem to imply that that may be the case. The way that I approach this in, you know, my office, or certainly within our anticoagulation clinic, you know, I think that as physicians and nurses and pharmacists, we need to be armed with the information about the drug, and we need to sit down and engage patients in this discussion. And to be honest with you, I think every patient should be informed about exciting and new advances in the field. With that being said, this drug does require some changes according to what patients would be accustomed to with warfarin, and this would have to be emphasized. Certainly, for example, this is going to be a twice-a-day drug, which I don't necessarily think is challenging given the large number of drugs that we currently use twice a day, but would have to be sure that patients understood that and just didn't try to translate what they've been used to for a long period of time. You know, and the other, I think, certainly a big area that has raised some concern is kidney function. And, you know, dabigatran is renally cleared by about 80%, so that there clearly are guidelines within the package insert about kidney function. But I think that with a new drug that is predominantly cleared by the kidney, you know, we need to educate physicians on patients who may have fluctuating renal status and, you know, how often should we be monitoring that? Should we even be monitoring that? And certainly the cost, I mean, not to put everything, you know, out there and dominate. Certainly I'm going to get Sam in here.
Yeah.
But I think that twice a day is going to be a departure, and they have to get used to that. I think patients are going to have to try to get accustomed to taking something that doesn't need to be monitored, because I think psychologically our patients are used to that, and this is going to be a bit of a departure. And then the kidney status, I think, is something that we'll have to learn about. How about you, Sam?
Well, the pivotal trial is the RELIE trial of dabigatran versus warfarin, and dabigatran had a one-third reduction in thromboembolic stroke compared with warfarin. It's the only trial where warfarin has been beaten in trials that go back to the 1950s. So it's really historic. And then the other important finding was the 60% reduction in intracranial bleeding. I don't think any of us ever imagined that a direct thrombin inhibitor would result in less intracranial bleeding than warfarin. And so these are the driving forces. I think that for new onset atrial fibrillation that meets the risks certainly of CHADS 2 or higher, where anticoagulation is unequivocally recommended, dabigatran would be my default choice to recommend to the patient, barring end-stage renal disease with a creatinine clearance less than 15. And then for those patients who are on warfarin, I think that's a different issue, because if they're doing fine and they have a high time within the therapeutic range, there's no particular reason to rock the boat. But over time, of course, there'll be more patients fitting that new onset of persistent or permanent or at times paroxysmal atrial fibrillation where the benefits outweigh the risks.
Okay, so fair enough. And Elaine, you mentioned cost. Is it, and I haven't seen any cost data.
Well, I mean, it certainly is a bit more expensive than warfarin. You know, I do think in Canada that the drug is about half of what I believe it is in the United States. Mm-hmm. I believe in Canada it's about $3.50 per day.
Okay.
But again, I mean, I think a lot of the issues around cost depend upon which particular pharmacy or drug plan is available. And I do think that as far as having, a conscientious pricing, so to speak, so that there will be different plans available for individuals who, you know, clearly have a need for the drug but may not really be able to afford it. So clearly an issue. You know, one other thing I wanted to make sure I didn't forget to mention is that it's very important for patients to realize that this medication needs to stay in the original bottle.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't appreciate this really up until about 6 weeks ago, that there is a very strong desiccant within the cap, apparently, of the bottle, such that the bottle, the original bottle, the medication, if it's taken out of that bottle, for example, and put into the Monday through Sunday pill boxes, it will fairly quickly lose potency. So, you know, I think that's something that really needs to be stressed, because I do think a lot of patients keep themselves organized by using a pill box, and I think that unless they get the blister packs, which I believe are used in Europe, and this may not be an issue for our European colleagues, but in the United States, I do believe that the drug is dispensed in a bottle. Was that your understanding, Sam?
No, I believe you can get the blister pack in the U.S. also.
Okay. But still, the importance of keeping the drug, and after 30 days, those pills really should not be used. So,
but that gets to the issue of compliance. So after 30 days, there should be no more capsules left in the bottle.
Well, one will hope that there will be no more capsules left in the bottle. Very good point.
All right. Well, that's good advice. Let's get down to some cases now, as postulated by some of the clinicians on Cardio Exchange. And here's one. If a 70-year-old woman with hypertension, prior heart failure, and no other major issues is newly diagnosed with chronic atrial fibrillation in your office, how would you counsel her on warfarin versus dabigatran in general? Sam, can you answer that?
Well, again, she meets the Chad's criteria for warranting indefinite duration anticoagulation, we'd probably use the term permanent atrial fibrillation at this point in a patient like the one you just described, Joe. And I would counsel her that the way to minimize stroke and the way to minimize intracranial hemorrhage is with the prescription of dabigatran, 150 milligrams twice a day. It's a capsule to be taken with food. I always emphasize that, and always to be taken. And I would, of course, discuss with her the alternative of warfarin. Most 70-year-olds have plenty of friends and colleagues, relatives on warfarin. I would discuss that as an alternative, but I would tell her my preferred choice is dabigatran, because that's the drug which in a rigorous pivotal clinical trial was associated with a 30% reduction in stroke compared with warfarin.
Elaine, would you counsel any differently?
Well, I mean, overall, I agree with what Sam stated. I mean, I do think that the efficacy with stroke reduction and the intracerebral bleeding really needs to drive physicians and patients. And you need to think about, if I'm not actually sort of counseling the patient about this new agent, you know, why am I not? And I think you have to understand, you know, are there other issues that we haven't discussed? I mean, certainly the 150 milligram twice a day dose was associated with slightly more GI bleeding, and, you know, although we couldn't really compare the disabilities of an intracerebral hemorrhage, certainly with usually the lack of residual impairment from a gastrointestinal bleed. But there is sort of that one caveat there with dabigatran, and I think that I would counsel my patients on that. I mean, right now, does it make sense, or do we have the information that for someone who's had certainly gastrointestinal bleeding in the past, what do we do with this particular patient? Are they at increased risk of bleeding again? And it's not, I think it's really the risk and benefit here probably still pushes me in favor of the stroke reduction and the intracranial bleeding. But the reality is that once a patient experiences the GI hemorrhage, I think it can be difficult to try to convince a patient that they really need to get back on that particular drug, which is one of the reasons why I think that warfarin is going to be around, because we're going to need to have some fallback for patients that either develop some GI distress, or for the patient who refuses to go back on the drug because they had, you know, a scary gastrointestinal hemorrhage. So, you know, I think that would be sort of one issue I'd like to raise, and I'd be curious what Sam would say to that.
Well, I think that in a 70-year-old, the same issues come up with bleeding, GI bleeding on warfarin. And it takes some counseling to get patients to resume warfarin after GI bleeding. And I think we'll have the same challenges with dabigatran.
Yeah, I agree.
Here's a more specific case. If a patient reports being on dabigatran consistently for at least 4 weeks prior to cardioversion, would you consider it safe to cardiovert without transesophageal echocardiogram to rule out intracardiac clot, given that there's no clear test of adherence to the medication?
Well, if I can speak about that, I think there are a couple of issues related to transesophageal echocardiography and to the risk of stroke with the cardioversion procedure itself. Point number one is that performing a transesophageal echo, a TEE, and not detecting an intracardiac thrombus does not give the patient immunity against a stroke during the cardioversion procedure, and can in fact lead to a false sense of security. My preference is always to give the patient anticoagulation for 4 weeks prior to cardioversion rather than do a TEE cardioversion. At times we're pressed to do one, because the AF is causing a lot of disability. But I think in general, it's better to anticoagulate. And I think we discuss the risks of cardioversion. I had always told my patients when I have them assign informed consent before I perform cardioversion that the risk of stroke is about 1 in 1,000. Mm-hmm. However, there was a most enlightening paper that appeared in Circulation in January 2011. It was a sub-study or a sub-analysis of the RELY trial, and it showed that regardless of whether you give dabigatran 150 milligrams twice a day or warfarin, the stroke rate is, to me, an amazingly high 3 to 6 out of every 1,000 patients cardioverted. Based on that information, I'm certainly going to change my conversation with the patient prior to the procedure. But I will believe the patient if the patient tells me that dabigatran has been taken twice a day for 4 weeks. I'll point out the importance of being truthful about it and the risks of, we always have a discussion about risks of stroke prior to cardioversion.
And how would you recommend managing dabigatran before and after non-cardiovascular surgical procedures?
Well, that's quite easy in most cases, unless the patient is at very high risk of a stroke or a thrombotic event. I've gotten away from this concept of bridging and simply omitting the dose of dabigatran the afternoon or evening before the procedure and omitting dabigatran the day of the procedure should suffice.
Dr. Heilig, do you get these questions?
These are certainly all the questions that are the most prominent. You know, I would like to say, you know, just briefly a few things.
Sure.
I think the RELY trial demonstrated that this is a potent anticoagulant. So I think physicians as well as patients have really gotten accustomed to this sense of monitoring in INR, or this, the comfort level of monitoring something.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think about the mechanism and the pathophysiology of, you know, the development of a thrombus, if someone has been on dabigatran for 4 weeks before a cardioversion, I mean, you believe in the medication, you believe in the mechanism and in the coagulation pathway, and you believe in the results of the RELY trial. So to still feel hesitant and to still feel that you would have to subject the patient to a procedure like a transesophageal echo to somehow make yourself, I think, feel better really isn't necessarily sound, in my opinion, because if the patient is absolutely certain they've taken the medication, then you've done all that you can to prevent something happening. As far as the holding of dabigatran for procedures, there is a table or something within the package insert that states, I mean, certainly I agree with Sam. They do go into a little more detail about, you know, if it's a procedure where there is, you know, absolute need for absolute hemostasis, to consider holding the drug for 4 to 5 days, opposed to a quick, you know, outpatient biopsy or something like that. So I think that it would behoove the surgeon and the proceduralist to be sure that they've consulted with the recommendations from the manufacturer, which I think certainly makes a lot of sense.
Given the dangers of not being in the therapeutic range because of non-adherence, do you think that more intensive or more frequent counseling will be required for patients taking dabigatran? And if so, what sort of initial counseling and frequency of follow-up would you recommend, Elaine?
Well, I mean, I think we've already stated that the, you know, adherence with this drug is going to be extremely important. I mean, as well as the other drugs that are going to be hopefully coming out in the next few years that may only be once a day. And when you remember that, you know, warfarin is hanging around in our circulation for, you know, upwards of 36 to 40 hours on average, that there isn't necessarily going to be, you know, the buffer per se for individuals who start alternating doses or skipping doses because, you know, they don't want to reach that Medicare donut hole. So, you know, I do think that patients should be followed initially. I think that it's very important to see how they're doing, how they're going, to make sure that they're not getting any sort of GI side effects and on their own decided to stop the medicine or not take the evening dose to see if that had an effect. You know, as far as the frequency, that's a bit tough. I mean, we don't really have anticoagulation clinic type of structures around clopidogrel.
Yeah.
And I think that that's a critical time after a drug-eluting stent to be certain that patients are taking their dual antiplatelet therapy. But, you know, I think with any important change or transition, especially for our patients who've been on warfarin, that, you know, at a minimum, I would probably want to see these patients perhaps once, maybe twice in that first month. And then thereafter, you know, I'm not sure what level of frequency I would want to check in, but definitely think that once or twice in the first month and then maybe every 3 months for the next 6 months or so. So not many visits, but I do think to just write the prescription and basically say, you know, this is going to change your life and, you know, I'll see you in a year. I think that would not be the best to help patients negotiate this new world.
Sam, what about you?
Well, I think in the same way that pretty much every clinician taking care of a patient, whether it be cardiologist, primary care doctor, physician's assistant, or nurse, will remind a patient to take clopidogrel after placement of a stent, we need the same type of collaborative engagement with patients who are placed on dabigatran.
To take a much wider view, one of the bloggers on Cardio Exchange recently commented that dabigatran may be the beginning of a paradigm shift where a lot more responsibility will rest with a patient. Do you get a sense that that may be true, Elaine?
Well, I mean, I look at it as a paradigm shift for really more from the need to monitor standpoint. And, you know, suddenly we have medications that do not require this every 28-day finger stick or venipuncture. I think that's the paradigm shift, that, you know, patients are not going to have to be concerned about having the three extra salads, you know, in the springtime preparing for the beach season. Or, you know, to me, those are the real world issues that I think bothered a lot of individuals when you first counsel them on starting warfarin. So, you know, I don't really buy the paradigm shift at the patient. I mean, I think that I see this a little bit differently. I see the shift more in terms of the benefits as far as the obstacles that patients have to, you know, go through or undergo or to face and getting monitored as frequently, because it's really not that straightforward. If you live a distance from the testing center, or if it's just difficult for you physically to get into a bus and this type of thing. So, you know, as far as the patient, I think, you know, we have to continue to find ways to help our patients be adherent with medications. And again, I'll come back to cost, because I do think that for many of our seniors on a fixed income, you know, my parents included, that this is a big issue for them. So, you know, I think with that, I would see if Sam agreed.
Well, I think that non-adherence to medication is a big problem. It's a big problem with warfarin. Patients don't take their warfarin. They certainly don't come in for their blood tests when promised. And so I think we'll face these same types of issues with dabigatran, and it's a problem for non-anticoagulant drugs as well. I think we'll have to do research on the best ways to educate patients and their families on ways to motivate better medication adherence.
Is it safe or fair to say that the dabigatran is going to make things a bit easier on the clinician, because he or she won't have to worry about that INR as often as they do now?
Well, I think in the short run, this drug is causing us to spend a lot more time and making us a lot busier. First of all, at the moment, and hopefully this is just a temporary phase, almost all the prescriptions we write are being sent back to us by the insurer for additional explanation. So in the short run, it takes a lot more time to successfully prescribe dabigatran. And hopefully over the long run, as systems get into place, the busy work will subside and we'll be able to spend more time counseling our patients about the medication and less time dealing with appeals to various insurers.
And here is a really long-range question. Are there any other major changes in practice that you think we should anticipate as additional similar next-generation anticoagulants make their way onto the market?
As I think about this, I think the world is going to start to get incredibly complex. And I only say that because, you know, not all of these agents are necessarily going to seek approval across indication. And I think that that will potentially create some difficulties for physicians, certainly in the hospital, if someone comes in with a history of atrial fibrillation and they're on one agent, and after their orthopedic procedure they develop a DVT or a PE. That would be one example.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the patient that, again, comes in with atrial fibrillation and has acute coronary syndrome that, you know, again, I mean, how are we going to manage that patient, especially someone who is, you know, over, or let's say, 80 years of age and above?
Mm-hmm.
And I think for these patients, I mean, physicians are really going to have to think about antiplatelet therapy so that they're not adding to the increased bleeding risk. But, you know, I think it's an exciting time. I don't want to sound like I'm not excited about this. But, you know, but I do think that there will be some indications, for example, valvular heart disease, that hopefully there will be trials or studies to assure us that these medications will be able to be used across indication. And otherwise, I think it could be a complicated algorithm as to how we actually care for these patients with different indications for long-term antithrombotic therapy.
There are studies going on now looking at using low doses of these novel oral anticoagulants for venous thromboembolism prophylaxis in high-risk patients after hospital discharge. Right now, we're using injectable anticoagulants, and it's quite possible that another major change in practice will be much more prescription of these novel oral anticoagulants for venous thromboembolism prophylaxis, both in the hospital and after hospital discharge, compared with the current rate of VTE prophylaxis prescription using injectable agents such as heparin or low molecular weight heparin or fondaparinux.
Well, I want to thank you both for your time with us today.
Well, thank you, Joe and Elaine. It's always a pleasure chatting with you.
Right, same here. Thank you so much.
Well, that's it for Conversation 115. Earlier podcasts are available at podcasts.jwatch.org. Clinical Conversations executive producer is Adore Yano. I'm Joe Elia. Join us next time. For myself and Dr. Danielle Schurer, thanks for listening.